the trunk that we made, the metal trunks. It had no utilitarian element or aspect to it. It was something which was just aesthetically pleasing to my eye, and that's the reason I did it.
Hey.
And created a completely different market, which I had no idea existed. was the fact that people wanted as a wedding gift or a coffee table, everything that I didn't think that might be used for, it was used for.
Designing for a global identity, expanding a brand beyond borders, Gautam Sinha is a globally renowned creator with expertise in brand strategy and storytelling. He's crafted the aesthetics of one of India's foremost contemporary design brands, Love Adori, which started in 2011 and is now a global identity for its creative craftsmanship. Hi, and welcome to the Design Pataki podcast, a show that deconstructs the Indian and international design world with leading industry experts. I'm Isha Gupta, the founder of Design Pataki, and through our podcast, we aim to promote thoughtful and incisive conversations on design, art, and architecture. Hi, Gautam. Thank you so much for being on the Design Pataki podcast. I'm so excited to have you here and to talk to you about designing for a global identity and, you know, how do you expand a brand beyond borders? I think that's what we really want to talk about. And thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You know, so my first question to you is going to be, of course, the most obvious one is, how has your journey been from, you know, starting this homegrown brand in Delhi, Hoskars, and, you know, expanding to Dubai, expanding to London? So tell us a little bit about your journey and, you know, of course, the challenges you faced along the way.
Right. Well, wow, that's a long one. Nothing was planned, to be honest. It's been quite a roller coaster ride over the years. It's been almost 13 years that I started this. And when I did start in Hoskars, as you mentioned, I was trying to do something which was going to kind of nurture me in a way and, you know, get my creative juices out. I didn't have a clue how it would happen and how it will manifest and what will happen. But I knew that I needed to do something. I was just completely creatively drained out. Working for other people, designing for other people, you know, and this was my outlet to do something. And wasn't really looking at making a brand per se. I was just trying to make a living. So, you know, it's more to do with that. Reality is a lot different than what podcasts and other, you know, publications do end up putting. But the fact of the matter is, at that point in time, I was completely broke. I wanted to do something that I would kind of enjoy, and at the same time, I could self-sustain in a way. Ignorance is bliss in a way, because I had no clue how to run a business. I had no clue how to start a brand. There was no, you know, guideline to anything. It was just going on your impulse, and that's what I did. I started with a little tiny little scooter garage that I found out. Which was not even 100 square feet. And started with a few products that I thought, okay, kind of look nice. And that's where it's all started.
You know, your products are more heavily leather-based. Was there a conscious reason towards that, or what gravitated you towards that material in particular?
Yeah, for sure. Like, you know, the whole idea of starting a brand also going back was because of the fact that I started doing some products in leather. Like, you know, I got an opportunity to design some leather belts for a Danish company. And they asked me to make some belts that they wanted to get done. I experimented. I had no clue how what leather was, what quality, nothing. And over the next few years, I kind of learned a lot about leather and how versatile it was. And just the fact that it was a premium product by its nature, you didn't have to do anything to it. It was, you know, in its raw, purest form, it's still a premium. And that kind of fascinated me a lot, because I started experimenting a lot and I started doing a lot of products. And And that's how, when I did start the brand, Napaduri, you know, the things that I had learned were the things that I was putting in the store as a product line. So I knew how to make bells. So there were like five different types of bells. I knew how to make trays, though they were trays. There was no method to that madness, you know, like I just, whatever I know, I will put it in the store, but I will curate it my way. And obviously it, like, you know, I am massively dyslexic. And for me, curation is very important, and how things are placed. That's more fun than actually making the product. So for me, doing the store was the most fun product process of the entire thing. And that's how it started.
So actually seeing the store come alive versus actually making the product excited you kind of a lot more.
Yeah, it was, you know, creatively venting out my frustrations over the years that had happened when I had to do things for other people. Because when you design things for other people, it's kind of a morphed version of what you are trying to create and right. what the client expects and then what the budgets are. So what comes out is really different than how it started. It's not in its purest form, but it's a journey. And so for me, when I wanted to do things, I wanted to do it my way. So yeah, that's how it's.
Taking from leather, do you have any plans of, you know, using more conscious material in terms of moving towards vegan leather? Or, you know, nowadays there's so many options available with pineapple, mushroom, coconut, Malai leathers, you know, a very popular firm down south. Yeah.
Again, I started this conversation with the fact that leather is a premium material and the fact that it has that value attached to it. As much as, you know, we speak about vegan leather and conscious living, I don't think a lot of people don't really know what that means, even now. And not that we will not try it. We have been doing our R&D for the last 2 years on it. And I just want to take a step just in the fact that everyone's doing it, so I would want to do it. You know, over the last 2 years, we have actually experimented a lot. As you said, Malai and the cactus leather in it. We have tried all of it. Eventually found apple leather, which was the most suitable for us. So we are kind of experimenting with that at this point of time, seeing how we would take it forward. I think by next year, first quarter, second quarter, you will see some small line of products coming out in that aspect. But honestly, you know, sustainability is such a prostituted word in today's world, and everyone talks about it and no one knows what they're talking about. You know, sustainability kind of starts at the root of any business. So if you're not being able to be sustainable and commercially viable, you know what I mean? You know, like that's my take on it. And it's easier for a really big fashion houses to talk about it because they have the budgets to do it, you know, and
100%.
Yeah. So like a small brand, independent brands like ours, have a really hard time converting that. But we are sustainable in a lot of different aspects, which I try to explain to people. You know, like you don't need to just look at the material. You have to look at the process. You need to look at the fact that we do small batch production. You know, our bags are handmade. You know, every karigar or every workman gets their due, and you know, and highly paid. And these things are sustainable to create a legacy in a way. You know, like, and it's not trend based. We do classic silhouettes, which are more slow fashion than anything else. You know, and these are the things that actually work well in terms of sustainability, not just the material. You can have cactus leather, a cactus leather bag made in China, and you know, and by a massive factory that's churning out so many pieces. How is that sustainable?
Right. No, sustainability has many layers to it. I completely 100% agree with you, and I think that crux of today's conversation is to understand how small businesses can be commercially viable. And that is important because if you start a product line, no one is buying it, that's kind of dead stock and you're going to end up throwing it or, you know, I don't know what one will end up doing with that. So I can...
It is something that we all have to work towards. And, certain countries in certain parts of the world will adopt it way sooner because they have the resources to. And some parts of the world have different problems at this point in time. And it will take its course.
The ethos of the design language that you have is very minimalistic, but yet it's got a certain Indian root to it. So can you tell me more about that? Was it a conscious decision or it's something that you've always sort of imbibed when you've been creating the pieces or, you know, how has that come around?
Yeah, I'm trying to coin the term Indian minimalism in a way, which does not exist. And we are trying to be the flag bearers of that in some way. Showing products which are high on craft and the DNA of the product is still
Indian.
Very Indian, yeah.
But it has a very global palette. It's got a global recall in that aspect. And I think if you want to be in this day and age, be a brand that's going to be international brand and kind of, speak everyone's language, then you have to have a product which kind of speaks that. And you don't need to be from Japan or from Denmark or India to understand a quality product. And that's where the essence of the design language that we started creating came from, you know, and we started giving a lot more emphasis on the fact that certain things that we do with the product are very Indian. Maybe Katar Niki Silai, which is like hand-stitched, or the way, you know, certain techniques and treatments on the leather are done. And I don't know, like, I don't know how the whole minimalism DNA came around in the last 13 years and has evolved. But I did start my career with designing for a lot for Scandinavian countries. And I think there's a little bit of a, you know, I don't even know what to call it. Like, I picked up on certain things which I really like and kind of, you know, and the same goes with, how do I explain this to you? I think...
Sorry, continue.
Over the years, I've picked up on things which kind of resonate really well with me in terms of how I see design. And I've always tried to translate that into my products. I'm a very visual person. And, as I mentioned earlier, I'm dyslexic. So for me, visually expressing myself is important. And uncluttered, very clean narrative of everything that I do. And that kind of resonates in the type of designs that come up at Nambaduri as well. And I think that's kind of worked for us because I think that's something that people found kind of new in India, at least, when we started doing bags which were really clean and just had like stitching details and had a certain price tag to it. And people came to us and asked, well, why is this at that price when I can get something completely different with lots of bells and whistles? And I was like, because you're paying for the design and not for the bells and whistles, and this is what it is. So we've stood that around and I think kind of created that market as well. It's been a kind of a hard run, but a fruitful one, I guess.
You know, I always tell people Indian design is not about peacocks and lotuses. There's so much more to what we do in. You know, it's also about materials, it's about the craft. It's not just about pattern and motifs. And I think, you know, Nambaduri kind of exudes Indian minimalism, as you rightly put it. And, you know, what I wanted to also ask you is if you could share, because, you know, a lot of people resonate with a product designer's journey in India, and it's a very hard journey. You know, interior design, architecture, I'm not taking away from any of them. The product design, the market sort of evolved a lot over the last 10 years, as you must have seen. So
sure.
I would love for you to share three, four, whatever challenges you personally faced, because I feel like we all learn from each other's challenges. And I think it's really important to share those. You know,
sure.
Expanding, creating the brand, three things which, you know, you felt were milestones and you were like, hey, listen, this is how I was able to like fix it, or, you know, any, you know, anecdote like that.
You know, honestly, like, I feel ignorance is bliss in a way, you know, and I had no clue what I was getting into when I did start this. Any advice that I might want to give to budding entrepreneurs or people trying to go and start this journey is don't take too much advice. Do what your instinct says. You know, you might fail, you might succeed, but you have to try. I think 50% of the people fail before they even try things out. And, you know, and the more advice you get, the more you get burdened by things. And for me, challenges that I faced over the last 13 years have been, you know, coming like, it's not something that you can plan, you know, like, and especially a journey like this. And there's never going to be a right moment or, you know, the right thing to do. You might have to go with a gut instinct on certain things. Obviously, India is not easy to do work in. You know, there's no business school in the world that can teach you how to run a business in India. And that's the reality of it. You know, you can learn the basics of business management, but how do you know man management when it comes to India?
Yeah.
And say that, I talk about not just people that are working for you, but obviously other elements that are surrounded by that, you know, and don't want to get too much into that part of it, but don't want to get in trouble. But you know what I'm trying to say, you know, like, and those things, no business school is going to teach you. And these are things that you learn on the way. And I just feel it's whatever you do, it's a exciting place to be and enjoy the journey, you know, like.
No, but what about when you set up London, when you set up Dubai, you know, you were looking for locations or setting up the store, you know, setting up teams, like, you know, what were, you know, a roadblock you faced, or, you know, any story from there?
Honestly, roadblocks have only been in India. When I did start my store in London, honestly, like, I obviously knew, I did a lot of study before I opened the store. It was not just, oh, I want to open a store in London and that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a budget that you have to plan. You have to see the location. I was in London for almost 2 years, sitting outside this one particular store that I really liked in Seven Parks on Monmouth Street. And it, I knew that it was a pop-up store because it kept changing after every 3 months. And I need to manifest this and make this happen. This store has to come to me because I know what I can create over there. And which they did, and we kind of won that contract or whatever it was, like, in terms of getting that contract and open up a doorway there. You know, like, obviously there's a lot more planning, but the transition was pretty easy, to be honest.
It's very clear cut.
Things you can do, things you can't do.
There's no gray area.
Like how you start a store in Delhi or in India somewhere. You know, you can start a store and you can do the most wonderful thing, and then suddenly people will come and say, oh, that's not allowed. This is not allowed. Or if it's going to be allowed, certain things you have to do. So it's nothing like that. You know, over in London or in Dubai, for it's you have a plan and you have to stick to it.
And if you don't have a plan, you will
falter and you will lose and bleed a lot of money. So you have to definitely have a proper plan. And we've been blessed to get the right location and at the same time have a product which kind of transcends internationally, globally, and has a certain language to it, which is kind of easy to palate
for the global audience.
So what I understand from what you're trying to say is that have a plan and, you know, take it from there and not sort of bleed money. But
What about sales, or what about actually selling the product? Has the brand been strong enough to have that churn as well internationally?
It's been a struggle, to be honest. You know, suddenly you're going from a pool of about 9 to 10 brands in India, which are doing something similar to what you might be doing.
Right.
To a city which is
international, has about 1,500 brands at top of their game. And suddenly you have to stand your own ground.
Mm. So,
you know, you're suddenly in a pool of 1,500 brands, and everywhere you look, someone's doing something amazing and brilliant. And that's the reason they're in that city. It's a fashion capital of the world. You know, and suddenly you're standing your own ground and having a flag around.
But at the end of the day, you need to make the sales to prove yourself.
You know, and I think you've done pretty well. We've been there for 5 years. We survived Corona and the pandemic. And sales have been gradually increasing, and they've been constant. But it's been a struggle. You know, I don't know anyone in London in terms of PR. I don't know anyone, you know, how things work. India's a little different in that aspect. You know, it's a small nest of creative people, and you can get your way around. And but in London, it's kind of been difficult in that aspect. And I'm still struggling in that department. And but we've been very well received, so which kind of helps. And we are in a lot of things. We are in a lot of key stores and key department stores like Selfridges and the Quantum Shop. And that's kind of helped. The word of mouth has kind of helped. So,
yeah, I think Nampatori has always had a very customer loyal base. Like, I think once you use one product, you'll keep coming back, which I think has been quite key and essential to the whole brand. But what I also wanted to ask you is, in the entire gamut of, you know, pieces you've created, which line would you see has been the most exciting to you, and what are you currently working on?
See, the one product that is closest to my heart is the trunk that we made, the metal trunks. It had no utilitarian element or aspect to it. It was something which was just aesthetically pleasing to my eye, and that's the reason I did it.
Hey.
And created a completely different market, which I had no idea existed. was the fact that people wanted as a wedding gift or a coffee table, everything that I didn't think that might be used for, it was used for, and not the purpose that I was trying to make it for, which was like to travel with. And but it's kind of worked pretty well. It's become like our signature product. It's something that is very close to my heart, and I still, after 13 years, is still the same product being made. There's no change to it, so that's been kind of fun to see that.
I actually had a request with that trunk, because I went to order it, and then I realized you don't think and the cabin size with it, and so I said, because I wanted to have my matching luggage, so at some point, please could you do an entire set so we can have it all matching, and the monogram would be it.
Personalizations there on the new range. We're going very travel heavy in terms of travel equipment by Nampatori. We have streamlined luggage, which is like old school vintage kind of a vibe.
Yeah.
And they are completely, it's a new range. It's a new element or aspect of the brand which is going forward, and I think we're going to be very focused on travel. And so you have your set, you have different sizes, you have a cabin baggage, check-in baggage, and now monogrammings there, you know, and lots of other things are coming. I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah, no, trust me, I looked, and it's really hard to find the specifications I wanted. And then I liked the cabin bag, and I was like, oh no, but there's, you know, it didn't have a bigger one. But I'm glad to know that that's coming soon. And on that note, my last question before we do a quick little rapid fire would be, where do you see Nampatori? Which cities do you see Nampatori in next? And... How do we, what plans say 5 or 10 years from now, since you've clearly got your schedule ahead of you?
Not really planned the journey like that in any way. You know that Cafe Dory happened just by the fact that it just happened. It wasn't part of the plan, but
It wasn't part of saying, hey, I want to do a cafe along with the line.
I always wanted to do coffee. I'm a coffee addict, and there was no good coffee at that point in time in Delhi. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do an experiential space where you can get a nice cup of coffee and you can come to my store and sit and explore the product. How do you retain that customer, which has such a, they need instant gratification, and their attention span's not too much. You know, you have 10 seconds to capture that. And how do you retain a customer who's going to walk into your store and spend 20 seconds to someone who will come into a store and spend about 5 minutes? It's a big transition.
So how do you do that?
And on longer than that. But I'm talking just in terms of coffee. But now, obviously, they spend hours. Which is now the other aspect of it. It's kind of more...
the other problem.
It's a completely different problem now. So how do you get them out? And not making them work on their laptops.
And get them rotating out. I know, you know, but I think everyone's been guilty of that at some point or the other, right?
For sure, and it's amazing to see that. To be honest, someone to come and spend the entire day at the cafe. No, but in terms of where the brand's going to go and where next, I'm sitting in the city that might be next, Copenhagen. So that's where I'm having this interview from. And I'm exploring. I think it's the place where if you ever want to get into Europe and go into product design, I think the city has a lot to offer. And I think it's the right city to get into Europe, especially in terms of product design.
So
let's see. Hopefully it will happen. I don't know. It's still up in the air. But we're planning. We're planning a couple of things.
So I hope to see you at 3 Days of Design. So I'm guessing at some point, whenever you do open now, Apodori in Copenhagen.
Supposed to be there.
So we're manifesting that for next year.
Really?
On that note, quick one word answer to the next couple of few questions. Vintage or contemporary?
Vintage, always.
Books that you would recommend, or books that you would recommend, since we're doing one word.
Books, I'm dyslexic, so I hardly read, to be honest.
Like a show, a TV show you would recommend?
TV show that I would recommend? I used to love Grand Design. So I guess that.
Your design philosophy in one word?
Capturing simplicity.
iPad or physically sketching on a paper or a sketchpad?
My iPhone.
Okay. Favorite candle smell? Favorite fragrance?
Woody and wood spikes, which is one of ours.
Something you should not do in design?
Overthink.
Isn't that for life? In life, generally. A trend you would like to see disappear for good?
Designer sneakers,
like designer sneakers.
Yeah.
You would like to see that disappear, just double checking.
Yeah.
Okay. Best advice you'd receive in one word, maybe overthinking again, but I'll give you an option to choose another one.
In one word or something that I can say?
Something you could say, yeah.
If you're the smartest man in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Well said. Thank you so much for this lovely conversation, Gautam. It was a pleasure.
Likewise.